Welcome back to the Rare Disorder Podcast. I'm your host, Shivani, and this is the 9th episode of my Meet a Fighter series, so let's get right into it. Today, I'm going to be addressing the rare condition, short bowel syndrome. This condition is commonly associated with the improper function of the small or large intestine, and sometimes it can be categorized as a cause or a subcategory of intestinal failure. So, how rare is it? 3 in a million people have this condition, making it extremely rare. It is a complex disease that occurs due to the physical loss or the loss of function of a portion of the small or large intestines. Because of this, patients with this condition have a reduced ability to absorb nutrients such as fats, carbohydrates, vitamins, minerals, and many more. So, what are some symptoms of short bowel syndrome? The first is diarrhea. This can be severe and lead to dehydration, unintended weight loss, a feeling of poor health, and sometimes even malnutrition, which leads to other health complications. Some other symptoms include cramping, fatigue, weakness, bloating, heartburn, and deficiencies of many vitamins, which also leads to other health consequences. Some causes of short bowel syndrome is the surgical removal of a portion of the small intestine, and any other disease, injury, or condition that hinders or prevents the proper function of the small intestine. This condition primarily occurs in 2 groups of people. 1, people whose disorder is acquired during life, and 2, newborns in which the disorder is present at birth. How is this condition diagnosed? Diagnosis is based upon a detailed patient history, a thorough clinical evaluation, and a variety of specialized tests, including laboratory tests and x-ray studies. For example, abdominal x-ray scans are done to detect signs of obstruction. CT scans of the abdomen and MRIs are also done. Some related disorders to this condition include Crohn's disease and cancer. How is this condition treated? The treatment is directed towards the specific symptoms present in each individual, so it will vary from person to person. In other words, it's highly individualized. Treatment may include total parenteral nutrition, enteral feeding, dietary adjustments, oral rehydration solutions, and certain medications. In addition, transplant and non-transplant surgery are also options. Transplant surgery would be replacing the disease small bowel with a healthy one from a donor, and non-transplant surgery would be artificially lengthening the intestines. Now I'm so excited to welcome Emily, who is a fighter of short bowel syndrome and intestinal transplant. She will also be talking about medical PTSD in this episode. I'm so excited to have you on my podcast today. To start, I was wondering if you could talk about an average day in your life with this rare condition.
Yeah, of course. My average day has shifted considerably. Prior to my transplant, my average day consisted of running IV nutrition for 10 hours every night. I was often in pain or at best uncomfortable. It was a constant struggle to balance my health and quality of life since my illness was progressing, causing me to feel more pain, more abdominal distension, or low energy due to near constant dehydration. I was able to attend college and work full-time while living with short bowel syndrome, but it required a lot of creative thinking on how to accomplish tasks or manage my time. After the transplant, life took a 180. I'm happy to say that I'm off IV nutrition, but still do nightly infusions of saline, but that too will soon end because I can now tolerate oral hydration, so very exciting. Mm-hmm. I take way, way, way more pills than I did before and see my team once a week, which is a lot more than previously, but that's only expected to happen the first year out of transplant, and it's been maybe only 7 months. I drink a lot of water, like I mentioned before. I can also eat more, and it impacts, because previously I would eat and I could absorb what I was eating, so I would eat whatever, and it didn't really matter. Now that I eat and I can sustain my own weight through food, my diet has changed. Before my transplant, I ate a lot of high fat and protein to keep my weight up, and now I eat in a more health conscious way. And I can exercise too now, which is really nice.
And then is there anything you feel that other people should know about this condition?
Well, with short bowel syndrome, a big part is dehydration. And that's what, you know, I was taking in maybe about 4 liters of fluids a day, which is a lot. With getting the transplant, is a huge decision. In my case, I was sick enough to eventually need one. But I had 2 transplant evaluations before I got one in December of 2020. One was when I was 3, and the other when I was 13. Intestinal transplants are not a common surgery. Only 5 hospitals in the nation do them. And on average, there are about 100 to 150 done annually. My hospital has only really been doing them since 2007. So there is a gamble with doing it. My family and I waited so long, as long as we could, to wait for the medicine to catch up. Because it's kind of a race against the time. You want to wait as long as you can for the medicine to catch up, but you don't want to wait too long and get too sick before, you know, too sick to get a transplant. Mm-hmm. So I ultimately decided to get one in 2020 because it was looking that the next 10 years would be even rougher than the previous. But I was also thinking about, like, where I was in my life. I worked full-time and at a job that I really loved, but frankly, if I had to let go of it, it wouldn't destroy me. I didn't spend decades of my career to get that job. I don't have kids. I don't have a mortgage. Nobody desperately depends on me. My parents are still alive and in the area, and they're not so senile that they can't take care of me. But also my dad's a doctor, and he can help me make those medical decisions versus if I waited another 10 years and let's say I married, like, a lawyer. I don't think he would be, not saying anything against lawyers, but if you're going to get a transplant, having a doctor in your family is very helpful, more so than having a lawyer. Mm-hmm. We all live in the D.C. area, so we didn't have to commute that far to get to the hospital. These are all the things that I considered, and I don't know where I'll be in 10 years, but I know where I am now. Simply in my 20s and figuring it out. So I said, hey, no other time is going to be better than right now.
Mm-hmm. And then how are you coping with it?
I would say coping is definitely one of the hardest parts. Mm-hmm. There's so much change that happens all at once and almost in succession of each other. It's almost like as soon as one thing changes, there's another change that follows it immediately. Whether that's with pills or hydration or what you eat. Essentially, my whole way of life changed after that one phone call where they gave me an organ offer. And so now I have to find a new way of living since getting my intestinal transplant. I've started yoga and physical therapy. I've also started to see a therapist. I think the transition is just very difficult and I've been struggling with it. I've reevaluated my life and career goals. I've reevaluated my relationships and ended some once I realized how toxic or non-reciprocal they are. And, you know, there's going to be a lot more changes to come that honestly, I'm not sure I'll cope with quite yet.
Mm-hmm. And then moving on to the next question, have you ever encountered a major struggle or obstacle with your condition and how were you able to overcome it?
Yeah, so this is, I struggle with medical PTSD. This isn't to do specifically with the transplant, but really my time as a patient since infancy. I've been gaslit. I've been talked down to. I've been lied to by professionals. I've been held down against my will as a pediatric. I've also formed many, many strong relationships full of respect by dedicated doctors who treat me as their equal too. But trauma is trauma. Not all scars are visible. My trauma has negatively impacted relationships with my doctors because I've entered the relationship expecting to be mistreated. I've had poor treatment outcomes due to being in a constant fight or flight response, because I'm just focused on how long until I can leave, that's hard for me to concentrate on what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. My personal life has been disrupted by medical trauma, making it hard for me to trust others or get close to others. I really only came to know that I was experiencing medical PTS about 3 years ago, actually through ballroom dance. When I moved out to the Washington, D.C. area, I moved for work and I didn't know anybody, so I thought, you know, this has been on your list for a while, why not do it now? Mm-hmm. And I quickly realized that this is very uncomfortable, because I have to get close to another person. I think there was some subconscious part of me that thought, I'm being judged, I'm being examined, I'm being, you know, this dance teacher is, you know, probably thinking, I wonder, you know, how is she physically doing? Maybe her spleen is enlarged. When he was not thinking any of that stuff, but that's where I was. Mm-hmm. So I use ballroom dance almost like exposure therapy, that, you know, you can get close to other people physically and emotionally and do those calculated risks. And it's not everybody out there cares about your enlarged spleen. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, through that exposure therapy of dance, I was able to analyze myself as well. I'm a lot more comfortable around people, but I still have a way to go.
All right. And then I know you have an Instagram page about medical PTSD. So if any, what are some initiatives that you take to raise awareness for it?
Yeah, so I do have an Instagram page right now, and I'm currently working on a website. The right organization called POP. It stands for Pissed Off Patients, but don't let the name defer you. This isn't like a angry, blind rage pissed off. It's more of anger. We're taught that anger is a bad emotion, not to feel and not express it, but I see anger as validating to yourself that something has happened to you that's not fair, and then taking that motivation, that emotion, to motivate you to make the change you want to see. So POP runs bi-weekly discussion groups on all things medical PTSD, whether that's gaslighting, whether that's dating, whether that's body image, whether that's, you know, how to form those close relationships and strong communication with your doctor, or, you know, when to just say, you know, this relationship isn't working for me and my doctor, maybe I need to find someone else. I also speak at medical schools about medical PTSD. Mm-hmm. I've spoken with Stanford, Georgetown, and UPenn, and plan to continue to. I would definitely, you know, check out the Instagram, check out the website. It'll be popmedicalptsd.org. And if you're listening to this episode and you're thinking, wow, you know, this really resonates with me, I wonder if I've had some medical trauma or medical PTSD, feel free to join one of our sessions. You know, you could be like, yes, I know I have this. Or you could be like, I'm not really sure, but I'm wondering. All are welcome to join.
All right, and then that kind of leads into the next question. I was wondering if there's any resources you would like to share that you have come across to help other people with either the rare condition or medical PTSD.
Yeah, so for the rare condition, definitely recommend the Olie Foundation. If you are on IV Nutrition or PN, it's called Or Tube Feeds. They are a great resource. They're based out of the Albany Medical Center, and they provide a lot of great educational material and resources on troubleshooting a lot of those PN and tube feeding problems, such as tubes clogging or, you know, swelling in the legs from all the fluids that you're infusing. It's just a really great launching off pad to really understand what is PN and how to make that a part of the life that you want to live. PTSD. I would say there's actually no other support group for medical PTSD at this time. There is some research out there. There are definitely, of course, a lot of resources for PTSD veterans or people who have survived domestic abuse, but there's really none for specifically that trauma that comes from healthcare experience. So I would definitely reach out through the website or the Instagram. But if you're just kind of wanting to learn a little bit more about PTSD in general, I recommend the book, The Body Keeps the Score. Again, it talks a lot about like the brain science behind trauma mixed with patient stories. This is, again, with veterans or abuse survivors, but while I was reading it, I saw a lot of it translating into my experiences in the healthcare system.
All right, and then, so just to end off now, I was wondering if there was anything else you would like to share. It could be general or specific, with my podcast listeners today.
You know, I am just thrilled to have been a guest on your podcast, and hit me up if you're interested in medical PTSD. I'm also connected to a couple of specifically young adult organizations such as Our Odyssey or Health Advocacy Summit, as well as the Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases that does policy work. So, you know, shoot me a message and I'm happy to introduce anybody to some of those advocacy groups.
All right, so I would like to thank you so much for joining me today, Emily, and helping share your story and really helping spread awareness for both the rare condition and medical PTSD, because I feel like these are things that are really not talked about often, and it's really great that you were able to join me today. So thank you so much.
Of